This conference is now being recorded.
I'm also going to try to record this conference.
Hi, Wendy. It's Nancy Williams. Can you hear me?
Yes. Great. I'm glad you got in. Okay. Wonderful. I can hear you. Just want to be sure you're able to get in without any problems.
I am. Now, what about for the screen? I see Dr. Marshall Chase, an audiologist, geometrical graphic.
Yes, that's Dr. Chase's presentation. So I'll just say, Ryan, when it's time for the panel, you will be able to see people. But for the presentation part, we're just going to have PowerPoint, okay?
All right. Can we do a quick test to make sure that my webcam is working? Can you see me?
Yeah, hang on for a minute.
Okay.
I'm trying to record this, so give me 1 second. Okay.
Sure.
Let's see. I'm trying to figure out how to do the recording, so just give me 1 minute to figure out how to do recording. I think I should do local recording. Let's try that again and see if I... Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and show the panel, and hopefully everybody can see their webcam. And let's see, panel with captions. Yep.
Oh, yes, great.
Work so far. Okay, awesome. Okay.
Hello.
So when it's time for panel discussion, I will probably mute my own camera and ask everybody to mute their own camera except the three panelists, and I think that should work then. Okay. So we have about a couple more minutes before people join us, but at least you have an idea of how this will work, okay? So anyway, I'm going to go back and put the presentation back up.
Okay. Now, Wendy, if I just leave this all set up like this and come back at 3:45, is that going to work?
I think so, but what you can do, Nassing, is at the top of your screen, well, actually, if you leave it like that, I assume you're calling in, right?
I am. Yeah, I could stop my camera and restart it.
Okay. If you want to leave the session, you can, because you don't have to be online until 4, right? So I would think you would you can try coming back, say, at 3:45.
Sure. Okay.
And then, you know, and call, yeah, in other, yeah, you can leave the session now. Click on option at the top of your screen, and you'll see a screen that says leave session. So you can use that to, close your screen and come back later. I think that's going to be the way it will work.
Okay. And then when I want to come back, I just need to click on the link again?
Yeah, just click on the link again and call in.
Okay, great. All right, thank you. I'll speak to you soon.
Okay, awesome. Okay, so I think we have a couple of people joining. So, yeah. So we have a couple of people joining. Yeah, a lot of people are joined, but we have about 5 more minutes of time. So if you need to go to the bathroom, now is the time to do it. So, yeah, and I'm just going to be back in about 2 minutes. Okay, so just make sure. So, and I'm going to leave the screen as is for now. Okay, I'm back online, and I want to make sure that if a lot of people are joining, so that's wonderful. It's not quite 3 o'clock yet, but I want to thank everybody who has been able to make it in here. So it's just great. Right now, I've been asked whether people can see each other's faces, and eventually that will come later, but in the meantime, I'm just going to bring up another PowerPoint for now. Okay, basically this is a PowerPoint that is going to welcome everybody, but hopefully you won't have any problem hearing. I just put out something on the screen here that says, if you cannot hear via computer audio, you can call in. If calling in, please put your phone on mute. And there's a chat box on the lower left corner. So if you have questions before the Q&A session, put your questions there, and I'll try to answer them. So, I don't know what's going to happen during the Q&A session, because I was going to have people typing the questions, but it looks likely there might be people who want to answer the question using speak, and they want to use their voice to ask questions. So one just had to play it by ear when it gets to that point. One just had to wait and see how that plays out. But in the meantime, I want to thank everybody who are joining in. Putting this together has been a little bit nerve-wracking because we were dealing with technical problems for the last half hour. But it looks like most people are joining and hopefully able to hear me talk. Okay, so my computer clock says it's 3 o'clock right now. So at this point, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and welcome everybody here. I also would like to thank two wonderful audiologists, Dr. Marshall Chasen and Dr. Brian Fleegor. Is this Fleegor or Fleegor, Brian? So,
Wendy, most people say Fleegor, but I've answered to so many different abbreviations of my name, whatnot. So just Brian would be just fine.
Okay, so Brian would be fine. Okay, so in the meantime, what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to go ahead and put Marshall's slide up right now. So it is a pleasure for me to welcome Dr. Marshall Chasen, who has so graciously and enthusiastically consented to participate in today's web conference. So Dr. Chasen is the audiologist at the Musician Clinic of Canada, and he has a very long and distinguished career in discussing hearing aids as it relates to music performance and music listening. And he has written countless articles and done so many presentations around the world. We are very delighted to have him today. Okay, Marshall, I'm just going to turn this over to you. Thank you very much for being here. Marshall?
How about now? Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
It looks like I have to use my phone rather than my headset, but that's okay.
Yeah, I can hear you. We can hear you now. This is good.
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
Okay.
I just got everything up and running. Happy Guy Fawkes Day to everyone. I don't know if you people in the United States know this, but for us, United Empire loyalists up here in Canada and the colonies, as we call it, over the pond. Today is a very important day because Guy Fawkes unsuccessfully tried to blow up the Parliament buildings in Britain, in London, years and years ago, before I was born. Maybe not as far as Brian was born, but certainly before I was born. And we burn him in effigy on every November 5th to show our allegiance to the king or the queen at the time. I guess it would have been the king at the time of England. For those that are not a British or Canadian or part of the Commonwealth, you have no idea what I'm talking about. Now, hearing aids and music is a really interesting topic for a number of reasons, one of which is that it's not a software issue. You can have your hearing aids and you can program your hearing aids until the cows come home and it won't make any difference at all. The issue has to do with technological limitations in the hearing aid itself. So it's not inconceivable to have one hearing aid for music and one hearing aid for speech. In fact, we used to do that in the olden days. So this is why this topic can also be called music and hearing aids, or more importantly, hearing aids is not a software issue. It's not a programming issue. This is a slide I like to put up. It has nothing to do with today's topic, but it certainly showed you the infatuation auditory scientists had with music in the olden days. This is from the 1880s, and von Helmholtz himself was in the audience, and he thought this was a viable explanation of how the ear filtered out and changed sounds into different frequencies. I personally have tried it. It doesn't work. And I've rubbed little erasers on different parts of my pinna, my outer ear, to listen for certain sounds and played it back to people that even had perfect pitch and they could not ascribe any sound. So although it's romantic and cute looking, it has nothing to do with reality. Music and speech are different, and they're very similar in some other ways. One area that they're different, wait until the computer comes around here. I think the computer's having a little bit of a slow point here. Let me just check that.
Are you trying to get it in? Oh, here it is.
It was just a limitation on the screen. I've got everything up and running now. It's okay. But there are four differences between speech and music. One is that we have differences in the shapes of speech versus the music spectra. They have something differing, which I refer to as phonemic versus phonetic requirements. In fact, my license plate in my car says phonetic, which is really strange. I drove up to a local fast food place, and they said, "What does phonetic mean?" And then I explained to the woman that you should never use a cell phone because the ticks that are in all cell phones climb into your ear and burrow into your brain. And I kind of drove away at that point. And the third difference is the differing sound levels. And the fourth and final point has to do with something called crest factors. I'll deal with each one of these very quickly. Talking about the very first one, speech understandably is coming from a human vocal tract, and whether a person is speaking Portuguese in Portugal or English in England or Chinese in China, it's coming from a vocal tract that's 17 centimeters long, has a nose in parallel to the mouth, the oral cavity, has lips and tongue. It's no surprise that the long-term speech spectrum is pretty consistent from language to language. However, in contrast, music has many sources. It can come from a violin, which is not all that dissimilar than speech, but it can also come from a percussive instrument, which is quite a bit different. So to say that we can use a long-term average speech spectrum as a goal for fitting a hearing aid, I think, is a little bit misleading. So this next slide shows you a spectral comparison between what we call the long-term average speech spectrum, or the LTAS, and a violin. And although they're not the same intensity, they have more energy in the lower pitches and less energy in the higher pitches. In contrast now, if we add on percussion instruments, and all of a sudden music looks nothing like speech. So the goal of a long-term average music spectrum that we can use to fit hearing aids is a little bit misleading. Another point, and I have to go up the screen, of the differences, another difference rather, has to do with what is important. So phonetic is what the musical instrument actually generates. So my clarinet and a violin can actually generate a pretty broadband signal going right up beyond the top end of the piano keyboard, and same with the lower frequencies as well. But what's important to me as a clarinet player is the lower frequency inter-resonant breathiness. So when I say something sounds great, I'm referring to the stuff below 1,000 hertz or on the left-hand side of the piano keyboard. Whereas if a violinist says, oh, it's a great sound, they are referring to the whole range of sounds, specifically the amplitude of the fundamental to the higher pitch harmonics. And if you change that in any way, it's going to sound pretty lousy. So a violin and a clarinet player may generate the same phonetic output, but their importance, their phonemic requirement, is a little bit misleading. And here are some pictures of my license plate and the other license plates I have called phonemic. I know it's really nerdy. You kind of have to wonder what's more nerdy, having these license plates or perhaps being so surprised that nobody has taken them before you. Another difference that we have is differing sound levels. This is a major one. Speech at its most intense is about 80 dB, 85 dB maybe, with the peaks of the vowels ah. They average at about 65 decibels, but that's speech. You can definitely yell loud, but it's really unusual. But normal conversational speech peaks are in the mid-80s. Whereas music, even quiet music, can be well in excess of 100 decibels, with peaks in excess of 120 decibels. So music is just louder than speech. And finally, the crest factor has been nothing to do with toothpaste, but it's how peaky are the peaks coming from a musical instrument versus how peaky are the peaks relative to the human vocal tract. And that difference is called the crest factor. For speech, the peaks are about 12 decibels higher than the average, whereas music can be 18 to 20 decibels. And that's because a clarinet or a violin or a drum set has less damping that's inherent than a human vocal tract. This is a picture of the crest factor. It's the difference between the peak and the average or RMS signal in decibels. So in summary, speech is about 65 dB, whereas music can usually, not just can be, but usually is greater than 100. It has a 12 decibel crest factor versus music being much higher, 6 decibels higher. Speech falls off at about 6 decibels for every octave, whereas music can be anything under the rainbow. In speech, for those audiologists online, we have well-defined what we call speech intelligibility index, and that is a measure of what element of speech or what frequency of speech contributes to clarity, to understanding. Whereas a goal of having a music intelligibility index is very ill-defined, so we're not too sure how we would handle that. Now, my screen keeps auto-ranging. I don't know about your screen. And context and conversation, we can miss out a lot of speech. There can be background noise. We can fill in the blanks. linguists and psychologists like to talk about this as top-down, where we can fill in the blanks using our brain. But with music, if we miss a note, we're out of it. It's unfortunate that we just can't hear it. We don't appreciate it.
Dr. Chaykin, let me interrupt you for a minute. I'm going to ask everybody to not try to enlarge the slides. I would like the slide to be set at 75%. If you are having trouble seeing it at that level, please download the slide from the link that you received yesterday about today's webinar, because there should be a link for you to download the slides. So thank you so much. Okay, and Dr. Chaykin, you can go on now.
Thank you, Wendy. The one big element in a hearing aid that makes it good for speech, good for music as opposed to just speech, is something called the peak input limiting level. Now, audiologists will not find this on a hearing aid specification sheet. You can ask the representatives from the various hearing aid manufacturers, and more than often, they won't know what you're talking about. It's not something like gain and frequency response. There's some of the more technical measures, but it's still very, very important. And it has to do with the hearing aid's capability to handle sounds over about 85 and 90 decibels. Now, keep in mind what I said before, the loudest component of speech would be on the order of 82 or 85 decibels. The quietest component of many forms of music is far in excess of 100. So what happens is that the front end, you have the microphone, you have this peak input limiting leveler, and then you have the digitization process, the analog to digital computer that does all the calculations and allows sounds to have these great digital algorithms applied to them. That's more of a characteristic of a digital system than the old style analog system. Music, though, can be extremely intense. There we go. So it just occurs after the front end. We sometimes refer this to front end distortion. But once you distort music at that very early stage, even before the computer and the hearing aid can be programmed or adjusted, once it's distorted, that's it. For those of you over the age of 40, you'll remember this gentleman. He's Max Headroom, and sometimes this is referred to as limited front-end headroom. I like the analogy of a plane flying under a bridge or towards a bridge. If that plane doesn't duck down pretty soon, or if it's not a drawbridge that goes up, we're going to have a major problem here. So think of it as a low-hanging bridge. And there are strategies I'll be talking about momentarily where you can actually duck under the bridge or have the bridge go up. But unless you go into the bridge, you're in a bit of difficulty. Same thing with a low-hanging a highway or a bridge that you go to on a car. If you don't have enough headroom, you run into severe distortion. Just from that again. So I did an experiment. And I had a hearing aid built where I could leave everything the same gain, same output, same frequency response, same all the stuff that we care about, but I changed the peak input limiting level differently. And what I'd like to do now is play for you some audio files of speech. Now, keep in mind the loudest components of speech is about 80 or 85 decibels. And the way this works now is that I'm going to set the peak input limiting level to 115, to 105, to 96, down to 92, and back to 115. The reason for 115 is that modern hearing aid microphones can transduce 115 decibels without any distortion. And in fact, they could since the late 1980s. So this is the paradigm. So first speech, and let's see if we notice much of a difference. That's 115. That's 105. 96. Perhaps the best hearing aid in the world. 92. And back to 115. Not a big difference, of course, between them because speech is so quiet compared to music. Now I'm going to do music at 100 decibels average, which is close to live music. It's not the music you'd listen to in your car radio or your home, but certainly live music. Same idea. Okay, let's see if I can play this. So this is U2, 115. A little bit of distortion because the peaks, the crest factor, is greater than 115. 105, you can start to hear the degradation. Coming up, probably the best hearing in the world. 92.
I'm curious, is anybody hearing these audio files? I can't. I'm just wondering.
And back to 115.
All right, Dr. Chase, let me try something. Okay.
Well, actually, you know what? Let me get back to the slide, because if you can't hear them, this is something that's available on a website for those that couldn't listen for technical reasons. But otherwise, just go to my website at www.chasin.ca/distorted_music. So distorted_music, and those audio files with a description will be there.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. So one could argue that the peak input limiting level shouldn't be in the 90s, where it typically is, but a little bit higher. So how have we as audiologists tried to resolve this problem? So somebody comes in, they have a wonderful hearing aid, they love it for speech, they've had it for a couple of years, they don't want to buy a new hearing aid, but it just doesn't work for music. So what have we as audiologists done to try to solve that problem? And there are four tricks or strategies we could do. The first one is that we can suggest that they, when listening to music, turn down the volume of the stereo or turn down the volume of the car radio, and if necessary, turn back the volume of the hearing aid or turn up the volume of the hearing aid. The volume control on a hearing aid is very late in the hearing aid circuitry, relatively speaking. So this is like ducking under the bridge. So reduce the input and turn up the output. You can also use an assistive listening device, such as an FM system that has their own volume control to reduce the input. You can use Scotch tape. This is a biggie. I use this a lot. 5 or 6 layers of Scotch tape over the hearing aid microphone deludes the hearing aid into thinking what it's receiving is actually much quieter than it really is. And fourth, you can simply take off the hearing aids. So without dwelling on them, so the first one, when in doubt, just turn down the volume of the input and turn up the volume of the hearing aid if you need to, not the other way around. That will significantly increase the enjoyment and intelligibility of the music. Second one is that there are a number of different technologies where you can bypass the microphone of the hearing aid and have an input with a reduced volume control. For those audiologists, every manufacturer has a kind of a guy in the back office we don't let out because he usually smells or he looks ugly or whatever. Who knows what the reason is? But he's technically brilliant, and every hearing aid manufacturer has at least one of these guys. And you say, I would like a little wire hooked into my hearing aid through a microphone, perhaps, that has a 1 kilo-ohm resistor in series to a 10 kilo-ohm resistor to ground, and that will be the sexiest thing this guy's ever heard. And that will drop the input by about 10 decibels. And so the input to the hearing aid will be more in the domain that it can handle. Third, using Scotch tape, it really is a great idea. You're going to a live concert, you're going to be performing live, you put several layers of Scotch tape over your hearing aid microphones, and it really makes it sound a lot better. It deludes the front end into thinking it's receiving a quieter sound. And finally, take off the hearing aids. So this is a chart here. You might not be able to see the entire chart, but this is the amount of hearing loss at 1,000 hertz you might have or the listener may have. Well, take, for example, a 55 or 60 decibel moderate hearing loss. For speech, average speech, they may need 20 decibels of boost or amplification. For loud speech, maybe 10. But for music, even quiet music, they may require 0 or 1. Almost nothing. And so taking off a hearing aid, even for those with up to a moderate loss, may be an effective strategy. Now let's talk about four ways the hearing aid manufacturers have responded to this. One is that they use microphones that are less sensitive in the lower pitches. That's where music has a lot of its loudness or intensity. And if they can reduce the amount getting into the hearing aid, getting to the peak input living level, or what is presented to the analog to digital converter at the front part of the hearing aid, if they can reduce that by 6 decibels, let's say at 500 hertz, and 12 decibels at middle C, which is around 250 hertz. I know it's 262, but we audiologists tend to round things off. That's a good idea. Another strategy is to shift that bridge level up, like a drawbridge that goes up and shifts in the dynamic range upwards. Another company has actually used a bit of a compressor to go under the bridge prior to the analog to digital converter and then digitally re-expand it at the end. And then there are some hearing aids, especially in the last 2 years, that have more than 16 bits in their system, which can handle higher level of inputs. So if you look at the first one again, many people with a high frequency hearing loss have good hearing still in the lower frequencies, the lower bass notes, or the mid-range of the piano keyboard. But if they're still using them, unfortunately, the microphone they use, which is a broadband microphone, which is equally sensitive for the left-hand side of the piano keyboard as it is the right, you're going to get some high-level, lower-frequency sounds overdriving the system, causing the distortion. So we can use a desensitized microphone, one that has less gain in the lower frequencies. Any hearing aid company can do this. To date, to my knowledge, only Unitron, a hearing aid company, has done this. And one of the reasons a lot of manufacturers don't want to do this is that when you use a microphone that's not broadband and it's only kind of cuts in the low frequencies a little bit, the internal noise, the noisiness of the microphone itself degrades. So if you look on the screen, the orange is a broadband microphone with relatively low internal noise, whereas the magenta or purple has an increased internal noise. However, if you were to use expansion, which is a circuit that many hearing aids have nowadays, you can actually reduce that higher internal noise to the lower frequency black line that you see there, which is almost the same. And in the top right, you see a gentleman who's a superhero, and that's expansion comes to the rescue. And all hearing aids have this, so it's not an issue that people should be concerned about. Any hearing aid manufacturer really could offer this. The second, and that's the distortion at the very top with a broadband microphone, and I'll just show you briefly what it looks like with a narrow band, or at least the other microphone. Again, I'll go back here. And sorry, I went back too far there. So there is, again, the high distortion and the low distortion once you use the specialized microphone. So it does work. It's a nice little trick. Another system that was first used by Bernafon that has now been used by several other companies is that the input level of 96 decibels isn't really 96 decibels. It's the top end of what we call the dynamic range. The difference between the softest sound the hearing aid can transduce and the loudest sound the hearing aid can transduce. And they said, well, if the difference is 96 decibels, not the absolute value, 0 to 96 decibels sound pressure level, why can't we take that same 96 decibel range and shift it up by 10 or 15 decibels? And that's exactly what they've done. They have a program called the Live Music Plus program that instead of it going from 0 to 96, goes from 15 decibels to 111, a range that's much more suited to music without distortion. And it's still the same 96 decibels. 96 decibels is an artifact of having a 16-bit system. And until very recently, that was all that was available in the marketplace. The third strategy, just flip over that. The third strategy, this is a same idea. Widex in their Dream, and now their Unique series, has actually done much the same thing, where they're able to change the dynamic range functioning to give you high-level inputs without distortion. So it's the input to the hearing aid that's the issue. This is an example from a study I did with the Widex Dream series, in that the red or the orange, I guess, on the screen is the old style, and the blue is the new style of hearing aid. On the left, high stimulus levels, like very loud ones like music, and you can see the preference level is much, much greater than the olden days, keeping everything else the same. And even with lower levels, it's slightly better as well. And lower levels are speech, human speech. And so this is an area that music has taught us about speech, and that many hearing aid people are being fit now, are fitting their clients, that is, with amplification that is optimized for music, because the hard of hearing person's own voice sounds better to them. It's not that they're speaking from a meter or 2 meters away, or if you're listening to the States, 3 or 4 feet away, but their own voice at the level of their own microphone is much more clear when you optimize your hearing aids for music. This is an example from Resound, and they simply say, well, let's duck under the bridge. So they have an analog compressor that runs off the hearing aid lead. It reduces the input. It presents it to the analog to digital converter in the front end. And then once in there, they reestablish the gain after. So it's like ducking under the bridge. And the digitized version is no different than what the real life version would have been without this ducking. And that's quite brilliant and quite reasonable. And the fourth area that the hearing aid manufacturers have responded is going in post 16-bit architecture, and there are hearing aids now that function as 18 and 19-bit systems. And for every bit that you have, it adds about 6 decibels in headroom. That is, you can take, for every bit, you can take up to 6 decibels louder sound in the hearing aid before it will distort. And there are many third-party manufacturers, and for those that like to do calculations, it's 20 times number of bits times log 2, and that's about 6 decibels for every additional bit. Over here. This is an actual untouched perfect slide of me dancing with my wife. And I said to her, 20 and log 2. And she thought that was so sexy. And as you see, oh, Marshall, you're wonderful. This is actually what really happened, believe it or not. Some new 24-bit systems. Now, when I say 24, their engine might be 24-inch, but they function more like 18 and 19-bit systems. But it's still much better than the 16-bit systems of yesteryear. Unitron North, Phonak Venture, Oticon, OPN, Widex, Unique. These are just a sampling. But this is the way of the future. It's the way of the present, actually, right now. And everything else. Not that I have one more minute, and it's not that I misjudged this. I think that unless you take care of that front-end problem, this everything else doesn't matter at all. And the everything else is that hearing aids should be less sophisticated than for speech. You should turn off the noise reduction. You should turn off the feedback reduction. Fewer channels is better than more channels, because you don't want to alter the dynamic range and the amplitude of the various harmonics of the music, whereas that maybe not that important for speech, it is important for music. You also don't want to have a frequency transposer in hearing aids for speech. We can take the very high-pitched sounds in presumably an area of loss damage and shift it into a healthier region in your ear so you hear better. That's great for speech, but it does not follow for music. The moment you alter the harmonic relationships, you're dead. So that's the everything else part of it. And one more thing, if we can't change the hearing aids, then maybe we can change the music. There are some composers, including my son, check out www.chasen.ca. That's a little bit of flogging. But he's actually created some music for children, nursery rhymes and nursery melodies, rather, for children, hard of hearing children, where the fundamental in the first several harmonics are all below 500 hertz in the kind of the left-hand side of the piano keyboard and the audiogram. So that's another strategy that we can implement. So here's my email if anybody does want to get a hold of me. It's marshall@chasen.ca. And also my musiciansclinics.com website has a lot of really good information on it. And for those that are interested, I do have a weekly blog at hearinghealthmatters.org. And there's about 8 or 9 of us blogging. And my section, of course, is called Hear the Music. Thank you. I guess I'll be on the panel session. Brian, it's over to you, I guess.
Okay, this is Wendy. Thank you very much, Dr. Jason, for your very wonderful and informative presentation. At this point, we're going to bring up Dr. Brian Flagg, or slide, and let me see if I can do this properly. Yep, there's Dr. Flagg, or slide. Let me see if I can bring up his audio files, too. You see, there's a... Okay, so Dr. Flagler has his slide, and I'm going to go ahead and enlarge it a little bit, maybe to 75. Great. Okay, Dr. Brian Flagler, he is the Chief Audiology Officer, and I had the pleasure of meeting him at the Berklee School of Music in Boston last year, where we were both presenters. So, and Dr. Flagler, I believe, has some extensive experience in hearing aids, especially for music performance and music listening. And he, I believe, it also developed a line of earbuds that are also, it's called the Ubero, and I'm going to let him mention it later. But in the meantime, please help me welcome Dr. Flagler, who is here today to talk to us about optimizing your experience with the audiologist. Okay, Dr. Flagler, the floor is yours.
Okay, Ryan? Wendy. Yep. Wendy, are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Thank you all so very much. Wendy, thank you very much for having me on. Before we go any further, Wendy, that the one file that's up right now, that is a video that I'll play for folks. It's very brief, but I have four other sound files that are .mp3s, and they're also very brief, but I'll just ask people to adjust the volume of their speakers so that they're able to hear a quick little hissing noise, just to make sure that it's nice and audible for you. Just
well, you have files. I'm going to see if I can find where I put them, because I had them yesterday. Okay, but you can go ahead.
Yeah, okay. We don't need them right away at all. If you need me to resend those to you, Wendy, that's no problem for me. So without further ado, thank you all so very much. I really do appreciate this. I appreciate Wendy asking me, and I appreciate Marshall going first. I certainly do get his Canadian sense of humor. I've heard many of his jokes time and again. I can tell you that his wife is an absolutely lovely person who tolerates his jokes exceptionally well. So she's a delight. Quick disclaimer for all of you, so that, you know, just to be very much in upfront, I'm going to be showing a number of brands of hearing aids and hearing aid manufacturers. I do not have financial or non-financial interest in these companies. I don't promote these brands. Some of them that I use for my own, you know, because I think that they do good work, they do a good job. But these are for teaching purposes only. I am the owner of my own private practice called Boston Audiology Consultants, and my descriptions here, my presentation, are my own opinions, and not those of Lantos Technologies. Lantos Technologies is a company that's developing a direct ear scanner, and as Wendy mentioned, we've developed our own headphone line called the Uvero, U-V-E-R-O. You're welcome to go take a look at it. So, apologies on the screen, the words cutting off of this. I'll just make mention of them. And in the handout, you'll have all of the verbiage so that you can read along with it. You'll notice that there's a fair amount of overlap between Dr. Chasen's presentation and mine. This is mostly because I've spent a lot of time learning from Marshall, and I've found much of what he's described to be absolutely true. One of the pieces that I want to highlight from this is Marshall raised the question, do you need to wear your hearing aids while you're making music? Quite possibly you do not. However, if you do need to use hearing aids when making music, How do we make them not sound god awful? Simulations that Marshall played, it was of a YouTube song. U2 song, with varying the amount of headroom that was available in the hearing aid, and it's just a striking simulation if you're able to play it or play it for friends or loved ones. So, to some extent, we're gonna talk just a touch on if you do end up using hearing aids, how do we make them not sound god awful? This has to do with optimizing your time with the audiologist. We're going to talk a little about choosing an audiologist. We're going to talk a little bit about how to not terrify that audiologist when you're coming in to see them. And we're going to talk about getting the most out of your time that you spend with them. So this is just a fantastic primer on hearing aids for musicians with hearing loss. I would actually say it's a fantastic primer for audiologists. I found that when I give this to audiology students and we read it together, I learn something new in it each time. Richard Einhorn is a member of this association. He's a composer with a hearing loss, and he gave just a wonderful point of view from the composer with hearing loss. And Brian Moore is an audiology professor, hearing scientist in the UK. And he just gave some wonderful points that I have since myself found to be true. But that's for your own reference for after the fact. Let's talk, I have about 8 points here that I want to start off with, talking about optimizing your experience. It's really important for us as audiologists and as musicians to understand that we have some rather significant cultural differences between an audiologist and a musician. Something that I think should be pointed out, just as an example, the audiology clinic is very quiet, typically. We have sound booths for the sake of being able to test the threshold of audibility in people who don't have hearing loss. You have to have a very, very quiet environment. Well, that very, very quiet environment may not necessarily be conducive to you bringing in your drum kit and banging away at it so that you can work with your audiologist to tune hearing aids. It may not be conducive to the trombonist bringing their instrument in and the audiologist doing an ear mold impression while they are playing so that you can be assured that the shape of the ear canal matches the shape when you actually will be using the earplugs or monitors or hearing aids. But so it's important for us to consider those cultural differences and respect those differences, but try to come to common ground, such as bringing up the point, could I bring my instrument to the appointment? Now, certainly if you play piano, you may have a bit of a limitation as far as being able to bring your instrument, but perhaps you have a portable keyboard that you could bring that you find is a reasonable proxy for the instrument that you will be using when using your hearing aids. As I mentioned, wind instruments, if we're doing any kind of custom fitted ear mold, whether it's a custom fit tip on your hearing aid or it's earplugs or some other monitoring device, having a very good fit in the ear is important. And we're going to talk a little about how things are how things matter. Questions to have right up front and address. Is the appointment length appropriate? For instance, if you're coming in for a hearing aid programming session and you want to bring your instrument with you, that appointment is going to need to be longer than 30 minutes, unless this is about your 4th or 5th visit to the audiologist, at which point hopefully you all have understood that you really do need to set aside appropriate time, and you need to have an audiologist that has a structure that allows for that duration of time to work. You may think that the audiologist is this person who may or may not have the patience to understand what your needs are, may or may not be open to your input. I would argue that audiologists are terrified of musicians. Musicians know so much about your craft. In fact, I would argue you are probably better at your profession than the audiologist is at his or her profession. We the audiologist, works very, very hard to understand what these mini computers do in our ears. We work very hard to understand how to diagnose hearing loss. We work very hard to help people to hear better. But we don't often practice 10,000 hours just to be able to start to be a master at our profession. Very senior audiologists have probably gotten 10,000 hours in after their first 5 years out of their graduate program. So bear in mind, you know a lot. You work in a very, very highly competitive environment, trying to get first chair violin in that orchestra means that you have been perfecting your craft, and it is a measurable performance difference in one setting. Audiologists tend to not have that experience. So you're very intimidating, musician. If you come in knowing that, then you may help to be able to put the audiologist's nerves at ease, and you may find a better experience. I would advise understanding what your priorities are and then communicate those priorities in advance. What I mean by that is I have a patient who is a concert pianist and is just absolutely amazing at his instrument, at his craft, and he also likes to listen to recorded music, his CDs, on a home Bang & Olufsen stereo system. He listens very, very often to string quartets on his home stereo system, and he plays in a chamber group. The string instruments versus his piano is actually a very different signal. It's a very different sound. And live versus recorded is a very different environment. If your most important piece is being able to play your instrument while using your hearing aids because you feel you need to hear your instrument or the instrument of people near you better, then that is the priority. Whereas if you want to listen to others or listen to recording, that's an important priority because we don't have unlimited time. We don't have unlimited resources. Therefore, we want to understand what is most important and invest our time in that. So I certainly don't mean to belittle audiologists. I am one myself. I'm very comfortable with what my own limitations are, and I understand them well. I'm also very familiar with the limitations of hearing aids. They are amazing little mini computers, but they maximize your residual hearing. They do not correct the underlying hearing loss. And so understanding both the audiologist as well as the devices have limitations, that doesn't mean they're not valuable, but it does mean that we need to understand where are those limitations and decide, is that acceptable? I would advise that we focus on whether or not the device settings make me feel confident as a musician. Am I more confident that I am able to play on time, in tune, rather than saying, well, it just doesn't sound as good as I want it to? I can argue that's a limitation of the hearing aid. An analogy that I've used with people is when you talk to another person on a telephone, you are getting a limited range of pitches, the frequency spectrum. It is limited because going over the telephone, it only gives you a certain range. It's historically, back when Alexander Graham Bell first invented the telephone, the focus was on 300 hertz to 3,300 hertz. It was that 3,000 hertz range, because that is very important for being able to understand speech, that range. Well, human hearing is from 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz when we're born and the hearing system is working quite well. So if we were to listen to our favorite song over a telephone that was only 300 to 3,300 hertz, that would not be satisfying. You could hear and you could identify the melody, but no one would choose to listen to it through that. Hearing aids are glorified telephones in large part. And so that is something we need to understand, part of that limitation. Now, do you feel more confident using your devices? Great. If not, then you're going to find, you know, maybe I need to not use them. But this is where we want to keep a sense of humor in all of this. It's okay. It's okay to not be perfect. Okay, so I'm going to show you this. I've talked a little bit about being able to bring your instrument to the audiologist's clinic and some reasons why that might be very important. I'm a huge, huge proponent of having a custom fitted ear mold for the hearing aid, regardless of what kind of hearing aid it is, if it's a receiver in the canal or a RIC device. You're more likely to consistently have the right sound going into your ear canal pointed at the eardrum if you have a custom mold. However, ears are weird. The ear canal changes shape rather dramatically. I'm going to bring up a video. In this video, it's going to show an ear canal. It's actually a scan of an ear canal where the person is opening and closing their mouth. Now, we might think of an ear canal as just a hole in the side of our head. It's a tube. And think that maybe it just is, you know, static. It just stays put. Well, it's not static. It is dynamic. So the eardrum would be up at the top of the screen, and the outside of the ear is at the bottom. And you'll see it's actually the front. See the on the right-hand side of that front movement, that is the movement of the wall of the ear canal. And so it's no wonder that sometimes, I'm going to play that again, it's no wonder that sometimes devices that are put in our ear have a tendency to migrate out of the ear or get pushed. There, go back over to my slides. So, Wendy, one note, when you have a chance, would be very good. I'm going to get rid of this particular slide, video. And if you have a chance to bring up those sound files, the MP3s.
I'm trying to, but I'm having a lot of problems. So I apologize if I can't bring them up, because I've been trying for the last half hour. So,
and you know what?
If
we don't have them, that is perfectly okay.
Yeah, all right.
Okay. Yeah. Just for everyone's benefit, though, I'm actually, I love doing these webinars because it actually gives me a chance to pop over to an email and send. So that is, of course, if I don't crash my own system. Okay. Well, we'll see how we go. Apologies, everybody. I thought I was going to be cute here and send something, but I'm going to just continue along. In the next slide, if you do have the handout, you'll see I talk about ear mold impression technique. Sometimes audiologists think about, well, do you take the impression with the person's jaw open, meaning their mouth is open while you do the ear mold impression, or jaw closed? There, move it over. Well, I would argue, and I have argued, and this has been fairly successful for me, that you do the ear mold impression, that's what I mean by that abbreviation, EMI, while the person is playing their instrument. On the left-hand side of this video, sorry, of this slide, is an ear mold impression with another ear mold impression overlaid It's the same ear taken two different times, and this is a heat map, meaning warmer colors like red and yellow and orange show larger differences from one impression to the other, and cooler colors, blue, green, dark blue, that shows as the surface gets closer and closer, more similar from one impression to the next. On the left side, this is where the person's jaw was closed both times, and I point out just inside the ear canal to past the first bend in the ear canal going toward the second bend down the ear canal, the two ear mold impressions are nearly identical. If I take that same ear and I have the person, I take a ear mold impression with the jaw closed and I take the impression again with the jaw open, there's a very large difference, relatively speaking, on one of the walls that happens to be the front wall in around the first bend through to the second. And that is where you see that yellow and orange. There's a fairly large change when the mouth is in a different position. So we somewhat end up chasing what is the right position for a person's mouth to be in. If you're a reed instrument player, you're going to have your embouchure around that reed and you're going to be playing. I would argue that that is the position that it should be in. Let's see. There we go. Okay. How do we choose an audiologist? First and foremost, referral from another musician. No harm, no foul. If the audiologist you have worked with does the best they can and you feel like you want to try something else, that's okay. I would advise you figure out if you've got a person who approaches challenges with a sense of curiosity and a stick-with-itness. It's important to be right up front and understand the finances. Hearing aids themselves are not covered under insurance almost ever. The hearing aid technology itself is very expensive to develop for the company, and so they pass that cost on to the audiologist and the consumer. Some audiologists bundle together all of their services, the time that they will spend with you, into the upfront fees, which in large part we think of as buying the hearing aid. Other services like my own unbundle, and that's where the device costs you whatever it costs me from the manufacturer, and I bill an hourly rate. And so if a musician needs to spend 3 hours with me to really get things nailed down, and we work very carefully and efficiently with each other's time, then that person owes me for that 3 hours of effort. But if they don't need more than 15, 20 minutes, which, well, let's be honest, when you're first fit with hearing aids, it's a process. But if a person, there's a big difference between a person needing to spend 5 hours with me and a person needing 20 hours with me. And so the way my practice works and the way a lot of audiologists' practice works, the time you spend is, think of it very much like an attorney. They bill you, my attorney bills me by the minute. Hopefully there's a little more flexibility on the part of the audiologist if you do find one that does not lump together the cost of the device with the services. And it is very important to that the audiologist has the necessary equipment to test and verify your hearing and your hearing aids. It's not always a given. So it's important to consider, do they have an audiometer? Do they have a tympanometer? Do they have a clear hearing aid verification system? These can be very, very necessary components for the work that you're going to do with them. Some of these slides are duplicative of Marshall's. That is on purpose because, one, he taught me. Two, it's important for us to walk in to our appointment with the audiologist understanding some of these pieces, and that most audiologists who have been trained in wonderful audiology training programs have had 90 95% of their time spent understanding speech signals and how an ear with a sensory neural hearing loss does not hear the speech the same way as an ear that does not have hearing loss. Music and speech are very different. So Marshall talked some about these different pieces. I add a fifth component to it called the intent of it. And I think of that as, are you communicating content, information, or are you communicating emotion? And I would argue that when we talk to one another, oftentimes it's communicating information, whereas music is about communicating emotion. So just very briefly, there's a couple of resources here, particularly the full complement of instrument and voice speech, or the spectral structure, the range of human voice, just showing down around 80 to 87 hertz, up to the fundamental frequency being around 1,000 hertz, and that really only occupies about three octaves on the piano. The piano has 8 octaves. Seven octaves. I'm so sorry. I'm not a pianist. But the range is just so much greater. Marshall talks about the peak input limiting. Really, he's right. Unless the hearing aid is able to tolerate sound levels that you would encounter in live music performance or live music listening, unless you have devices that can manage that, then all the rest of it just doesn't really matter quite so much. But let's say, and there are many instruments that do in fact have appropriate input levels, do accept levels that are up at appropriately high levels. I've found that giving the musician the option of self-tuning is very important, and that's been very helpful in people getting through their through this. So just to show very briefly, here's an example of a hearing loss that almost certainly would not need to use hearing aids. No, despite they have what would be considered a moderate degree of hearing loss in the mid to high frequencies. Average level live music would sound the same to them as a person with normal hearing, and that's because sensory neural hearing loss changes your access to soft sound, but once a sound is adequately loud above your threshold of audibility, it sounds just as loud to you with the hearing loss as it does to the person with normal hearing. I'm going to jump past these slides. I'll let you take a look at them, especially because they're so very small. But what I've pointed out is in this one particular manufacturer's programming, I have in here an all-around program, which is a default programming. And there's a lot of really advanced options related to directionality and how fast the compression works. And I contrast that with the music program where basically everything, all of the advanced signal processing is shut off, and the compression on this device, the time constants, are set to as slow as they can, because that is something I have found to matter, is that if you're trying to understand speech, having very fast compression helps you to hear that speech, hear the difference in speech cues. Whereas music, being so very different from speech, benefits from having slower compression. And I know I'm running out of time here. Wendy, thank you so much for being patient with me. When thinking about maximizing your time with the audiologist, some of this is understanding what makes one hearing aid better than another. Lots of them are fantastic. Some of these, and I just show an app that allows for a little bit of self-tuning, where you can do some adjustment to bass and treble, where it pops up, and it's very rough. It's a very rough adjustment, but it's a linear adjustment for both soft as well as loud sound. But you could change the relative balance between bass and treble and then save that that particular change in your own program. Just to mention as I wrap up here that there's I'm not using any of my patients who are musicians as this case example, just in case one of my patients happens to be watching and I don't want them to feel uncomfortable. But this particular individual is not a musician, but goes to live shows at least once a week, if not more. And he needs to use his hearing aids for work purposes. He needs to hear people from a distance and communicate very effectively. And he uses invisible in the canal hearing aids. And just to show you very briefly, here's his audiogram. He has very good hearing in the low frequencies, and he has a moderate degree of hearing loss. It starts sloping off at about 2,000 hertz. And so he has a normal program. He has a music program, yada, yada. That's all great. The default programs for any of the hearing aid technology or hearing aid companies I have found to not be all that satisfying. What helped him was this particular manufacturer has an app that you can run on your iPad or on the computer during the hearing aid fitting session where we played his favorite recorded music. He's listening. He's a live music fan. At the sound levels of normal live music, this is about 90 to 95 decibels, and he made adjustments tracking along on his finger in this space. Just literally, you see this, you know, looks like a wandering through the desert kind of back and forth. This space is changing relative levels between bass and treble as well as compression ratios. And we found something that he thought, yeah, between these different changes I'm making sounds pretty good. And so the final end result is that he loved his music program. Despite the fact he had such good hearing in the low frequencies and probably would be able to hear most music just fine without hearing aids, because of self-tuning, we were able to tweak it just right where he, in fact, preferred listening to live music with his hearing aids in. Wasn't totally satisfied with other programs, but after a little bit of practice and work, we got there just fine. So this is the end of my presentation, despite there are six more slides. These are for your benefit, you and the audience, for you to read through and share with your audiologist. Just know, please credit me with that because I may be wrong or right, and they should know who to blame. So with that, I just wanted to say thank you very much and then turn it right back over to Wendy.
Hi. Thank you very much, Dr. Flagar, for doing such a wonderful presentation. We're going to start our panel discussion right now, and let me see if I can bring up the panel view. Yep. So I have Nassim and, let's see, Adam's online. Charles Makatov should be online, too. I don't know where Charles Makatov is. Charles, are you online? There you are. Awesome. I am going to ask everybody except for Adam, Nassim, and Charles to turn off their webcams so we can focus on our panelists. And great. Thank you so much. I think I'm going to go ahead and start by welcoming Adam and Charles and Nancy here, and thank you so much for taking the time to, out of your very busy weekend, to join us to talk a little bit about your experience with music and hearing aid. My first question for each one of you is, can you please discuss a little about your audiological history and also your musical history? I think it's always different for everyone because the general public is familiar with people who lose their hearing late in life. They're familiar with musicians who lose their hearing late in life, but they are often not aware of people who have hearing loss first before learning about music. And I believe every member of this panel, except for Charles, actually, I should say Nancy and Adam, I think, have a slightly different history than Charles, but I'm going to go ahead and let you all speak for yourself. So I'm going to have Nancy start, and Nancy, can you tell us a little bit about your audiological history and your music lessons? Okay. We can't hear you. Let's see. Yeah. Are you using your phone now?
Can you hear me now?
Excellent, yes.
Okay, great. Well, I was saying I'd be happy to answer the question, and I wanted to start out by saying how happy I am to be on this panel. I scrolled through the participants and saw some familiar names there. So it's going to be part of this conference. Anything that Wendy puts together is always very much worth a time. So thank you for having me, Wendy. My audiological history and my musical history are very much intertwined. Although, as Wendy pointed out, I found out and my family found out about my hearing loss before I actually began studying the piano. My hearing loss is genetic. I have the connection 26 gene mutation. And I was first diagnosed with my hearing loss at age 6, although I was probably born with it in some form or fashion. And at that time, my hearing loss was mild in the high frequencies only. But nonetheless, the audiologist who diagnosed me at the university where my father taught recommended that I get hearing aids, and my parents, understandably, especially given the time that they were in, were worried about the social impact of their daughter wearing hearing aids, so they declined the audiologist's recommendation. And then meanwhile, at age 11, I started playing the piano. I was immediately smitten by it. I loved it, and I sometimes when I was on my way to, you know, run an errand or do something else, even as an 11-year-old, I would just dash off a few bars on the piano. Practicing was never a problem for me. I always really enjoyed it. But then when I got into junior high school, I had some social difficulties. Ironically, the thing my parents feared had happened anyway because I couldn't hear. I wasn't able to hear girls whispering in the lunchroom, my friends, you know, and whispering was and still is a staple of middle school experience. So I was actually asked to leave a group, you know, still haven't forgotten this, because I couldn't hear secrets. And at that point, my parents realized that I needed to be fit with hearing aids. And I only received one. I was 12 years old, and I was very self-conscious of it. I remember kind of pushing down on the tubing. It was a behind-the-ear model. I remember pushing down on that tubing, trying to disguise it when I was in school. But it helped a lot, and it really helped on the piano, definitely, because as Dr. Flagger was pointing out, the range of the piano is so much broader than speech, and by the time you got into those upper two or three octaves, even then I was having trouble, you know, hearing without the aid. So I studied the piano very seriously until I was 16, and at that point, unfortunately, my hearing loss and the piano became intertwined in a way that was very unproductive. And I was asked to quit the piano by my parents, partly for financial reasons, but also because they felt that with my hearing loss, I would never be a concert pianist. So one of the things that was most dear to me left my life. And at the same time, I became very ashamed of my hearing loss. Because it was one of those, I felt as though it was the force that had caused me to lose an activity that was most dear to me in life. And I didn't touch the piano for years. And instead, I pursued a business career, and I still am in business today. And meanwhile, my hearing loss, as I've written about this, started sliding down the audiological chart, and such that I now have a moderate loss sloping to severe in the high frequencies. And all this time I was fitted with progressively better hearing aids. And then in my early 40s, a miraculous thing happened. My son, who has wonderful rhythm and an amazing sense of musicality, started piano lessons, and my husband went with him. And that was the catalyst that drew me back to the piano, and it was like falling in love all over again. And I started taking lessons, and I haven't quit since. I've been taking a weekly lesson ever since. I started performing, and I rolled out my website, Grant Piano Passion, because I felt that for me, in some ways, the piano had saved my life, and I wanted to communicate all of the joy that I get playing and practicing to others. And I also, but I didn't really go public about my hearing loss until after I started publishing Grand Piano Passion for a couple of years. And then I started writing about that too, and now I speak frequently on on hearing loss and what it means to be a mother and a wife with hearing loss, what it means to be a musician with hearing loss, and also what it means to be an executive with hearing loss. It's part of all of those worlds. And so the two are, I think, the music and the hearing loss still are very much intertwined for me, because a lot of times when I speak, I play the piano for people. So that's my story.
Thank you, Nancy. Okay, Adam, can you share your story with us, please?
Of course, yeah. So Nancy, well, first of all, I want to start off also by thanking you, Wendy, for bringing us all together. These are always wonderful events that you put together, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be a part of it. Nancy, my hearing loss is probably congenital, although I didn't actually discover that until recently. I was diagnosed around 4 years old, with hearing loss and aided quite soon thereafter. So from about 4 or so until now. And of course, at that time, hearing aids were still the old analog aids. For me, the music started off when I was around 8 years old or so. although I had been involved in music classes in elementary school before then as well, I, for some reason, and I don't know why, but I went to my parents and told them that I wanted to play music, and they agreed to take me to an event that was happening that night at my school, and I picked up the cello to start off on. I have no idea why I was attracted to that. Well, I have some more idea now, which we'll probably get to. It sort of fits with my hearing loss, which happens. So my hearing loss is a cookie bite loss, which is sort of a cutout in the middle of the frequency ranges. It's very common for a genetic type of loss to have that picture. I have some low frequency hearing still, and so probably low instruments like cello were attractive to me for that reason. Soon thereafter, though, the next year, my elementary school choir teacher approached my parents and asked if I would try out for a choir. I can't have been that good of a singer, but apparently she told my parents that that I tried real hard, and that's why she wanted me in the choir. But that sort of started music off as being a very defining part of my early life, and so I went on to play different instruments. In the summers, I would go to music camps, and it became a very important part of my growing up, a social outlet in addition to obviously a musical one. So in terms of how the hearing loss fit in with that, I wasn't particularly aware of any difficulties that I should have had at that time. And I asked my parents, actually, what could I do to help to be able to hear music and participate in that way? And they told me that really all I did is I would adjust the hearing aids and just make little changes, I guess just to the volume is what I was doing, and I was able to make it through in that way. But music continued to be a huge part of my life all the way through high school, and then I studied in college the bassoon, went on to be a professional bassoonist, played in China for about 3 years in an orchestra there. But the hearing loss itself, as I sort of progressed up the chain of becoming a professional musician, the hearing loss itself really became more important for me to think about more. And I think as I if it became apparent that I really needed to hear a little bit better than I was hearing. So I, you know, switched hearing aids and did a lot of tweaking and worked a lot with audiologists and things like that in order to make that process work. And that's been a much sort of longer process for me in order to sort of make sure that all that was working.
Let me stop for a minute. Okay, we're going to talk a little bit about your experience with hearing aid in a little while, but right now I would like Charles to share his story. So Charles, thank you for popping back up on video. I was wondering where you had gone to, but go ahead and share a little bit about your hearing loss and how you ended up playing guitar. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Thanks. I watched myself disappear too, and I've been struggling with this. I'm not sure exactly why, but I'm sure you can hear me now. I'm hoping you can hear me now.
Yes.
My story is good. My story is similar to Nancy and Adam's. From what I'm catching, the difference, especially between Nancy and me, is that I was about 15 when I had a sudden overnight loss. And you know, my audiogram today in 2016 looks pretty much the same as it did when I was 15. So I it was terrible then, and it's terrible now, but it hasn't gotten any worse. I'd say terrible. I mean, a better description would be basically a severe loss. I go as bad as 90 in some frequencies. When I was fairly young, 12 or 13, I was playing guitar. I grew up in a town where there wasn't really much else to do but play in some terrible rock band or another. So that's what just about everybody did, with or without hearing loss. And the interesting thing about it, and I think back about it, I had one analog aid. And, you know, there wasn't any experience of me going to an audiologist and having them make a guitar sound better. It just was offline, louder software. But it wasn't until the digital age that I got obsessed with getting this right. If we have time to share some of the things that I've learned that have worked for me. I think as a classical guitarist, no question, on the panel here, I have the quietest instrument. It's probably the easiest of the three, compared to bassoon and piano, to get things right. I don't know. But I'm a very persnickety kind of guy, very fussy. It goes with us, with the territory being a guitarist. If you know any classical guitarists, that's how we are. So not only do I mess around with guitars and strings, I also mess around hearing aid brands and drive audiologists crazy. But basically, I've been playing guitar ever well before, and I didn't let it stop me. So that's in a thumbnail where I am now.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Charles. Getting back to Nancy, here's our second set of questions, which is, can you kind of briefly describe your experiences getting at the hearing aid that was right for you when playing piano? Nancy?
Okay. Well, that is a very good question, Wendy, and I'm not sure whether I still have got this completely right. And while Dr. Brian Flygar was speaking, I was calculating in my mind how feasible it might be for me to periodically drive up to Boston from Central Connecticut to get treated by him, because I think it really is an ongoing process. I currently wear Phonak hearing aids, and I do have, of course, a music setting programmed in there. But I actually have three versions of the music setting programmed in my hearing aids. And the first one is just the regular music setting dampened by 3 decibels. And the second one is dampened by 6 decibels, and the third by 8. And I actually almost always use the third music setting option, which is the manufacturer's suggested music setting with compression removed. I'll say more about that in a minute. Dampened by 8 decibels. And I didn't come up with this idea myself to dampen the music setting. I was actually remember reading in the first book that Wendy edited and produced for the association some recommendations by Dr. Marshall Chasen that typically the music setting for the manufacturer's music setting is really designed more for listening and playing, and that it's often too loud. So I started experimenting and playing around with that, and It's true what Dr. Brian Flygor says, that most audiologists are not really trained to work with musicians. I had to lead my audiologist through this process, and it took me several sessions to convince her that she ought to be trying out some of these ideas that I had been reading about from people who specialize in music and hearing loss. But once we did that, I kind of arrived at those settings that I use. The other thing is, and I believe this is unique to Phonak, although I would defer to some of the experts who've already spoken, is that the music setting for Phonak does use compression, which makes absolutely no sense at all. So, for example, they may be taking a B flat in a very high octave and compressing it down to D in another octave. It's completely garbling the music. So I actually have had some interactions with Phonak, and I'm in touch with one of their top executives. So I emailed him on this and said, I'm really concerned. Can you do something about this? And I haven't really received a definitive answer. But I think as a community, we need to speak up about some of these oddities of the music setting that are really quite incompatible with the act of making music. Having said all this, I am now about 5 years into this pair of hearing aids that I have currently. They're behind the ear model. They're the NADA, I believe that's how you pronounce it. So I'm thinking about what my next model should be, and I'm probably going to try a couple of them, and hence my calculations about whether I could drive up to Boston every couple of weeks to get fitted. So that's the experiences that I've had.
Nancy, I think that hearing aid you're talking about called the Phonak NAIDA. Okay, NAIDA. I believe that's how it's pronounced. NAIDA. They are,
yes.
Phonak work with Advanced Bionic for still that a version of their technology or some part of the technology is with their cochlear implant, so I am familiar with a NAIDA. Okay. Adam, what kind of hearing aid do you have?
Yeah, so right now I'm using the Oticon Agile P. That was after a long series of trying lots of different manufacturer's aids with an audiologist who was very, very kind to me and let me...
Adam, can you please spell the model and the make of your hearing aid, because I don't think our captioner got it.
Okay, yeah, I'll actually put it in the message here. It's the Oticon Agile P.
Okay, it's the Oticon Agile Pro, right?
Yeah, it's
okay.
Agile Power Pro, yeah. And so that was after a long period of trying a bunch of different aids, for the latest ones. Before that, probably the ones I had the most success with music were an older Oticon, the DigiFocus 2, and that's what I wore for most of my music career. I'm not really performing anymore. I've left the music profession now, but I have been able to make the current aids work reasonably well. And, you know, I think that the resources that Dr. Chasen especially has for fitting and things like that have been just absolutely tremendously valuable. I've used the Scotch tape thing. That really worked well for me. I put some cotton, I think that might have come from him as well, putting some cotton fluff or pieces of cotton ball in the tubing. That really worked for me as well as an attenuator. You know, for me, it's been a real process of trial and error, and also just a tremendous relationship with some audiologists who were just extremely kind to me and let me sit around their offices at lunchtimes for like a week and mess around with my settings. So it's been a long process.
Charles, can you please tell us a little bit about the hearing aids you use now?
Sure. I'm wearing right now the Resound Lynx Squared, but it's L-I-N-X with a 2. I guess it would be a superscript 2, but it's just spelled L-I-N-X with 2. This year alone, I've tried 4 hearing aids. I used to use the Phonak Naida, which was just great. I mean, I thought it was just great. It was an older one, a receiver in canal. So I waited for the new one to come out, and I could not get this to work. I have a very patient audiologist. We work together. I will admit that I'd say I do about 80% of the work. I come in, I do the research, I bother Marshall, I bother Brian. They both know me well. I come in sometimes even. I had Marshall on the phone, the audiologist, who thank you, Marshall. This never worked. And so then I moved on to a Starkey aid. I can't remember the Muse, M-U-S-E. That didn't work very well for me either. Then I moved on earlier this year to Widex. Now that is a good hearing aid. But I got really turned on by this Resound thing because no wires. And the iPhone, it's just, I can't tell you how much, forget about music for a brief second, how wonderful it is to listen to audiobooks and your GPS through the car and talk on the phone and understand everybody and do what I'm doing now without wires. And so I got to get this Resound thing to work. Because for a while I was putting the old Naidas to play and putting these Resounds in for everything else. But and I'm going to give credit to Brian here because he doesn't realize it, but he gave me a tip that just it made it work. My process was very similar to what Adam does. Very long, very patient audiologists. Again, most audiologists are not good at this. If you want more, gory details about what worked for me, again, this is for me personally with my loss and, again, on the classical guitar, because that's what I care about the most, I'll be happy to share that with you.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. So I'm just going to throw it out to the three of you, and anyone can choose to answer. In your experience, what has been the best strategy during your adventure in trying out hearing aids? How do you communicate? What do you do to tell your audiologist to keep working with me until we get this to work? Is there anything you would like to leave our participants in their when they work on their own journeys with their audiologists?
I'll mention something, Wendy, if I can jump in. That one, what the problem is in its vocabulary. You can't just say to the audiologist, gee, I don't know, that doesn't sound that good. Can you make it better? I mean, you have to get very specific. If you can get specific about frequency, you can get very specific if you know the language, if you understand, then you can help them. Oftentimes, in the very beginning of this process, I would say, we really need more bass. So they brought the bass up. I went home and I realized that I just completely blew the top end of it. I can't hear any of the notes on the top of it. So I go back and I think a lot of this is you need to be educated. I don't know. There are very few audiologists. 2 of them are probably on the phone here, Marshall and Brian. But other than them, most of them, you're going to have to do the work. So that's what's helped me the most by basically studying.
Okay. Nancy, Adam, do you have anything to add?
I do. I totally agree and underscore with what Charles just said. And I think once you've educated yourself, then the question is, how do you communicate that to your audiologist in a way that makes them a partner in your journey to hear music better? Ideally, you'd be able to set the expectation with them right at the time that you purchase your hearing aids, and to make sure that they understand that you are a musician, that you have different needs, that you may be coming back frequently for tuning and changes as you explore how these aids sound when you play the piano or the classical guitar or the bassoon or whatever your instrument might be. And I think just like anything, you get what you pay for. So having an audiologist who may charge you a little bit more for the hearing aids but then has unlimited visits, if that works with your particular financial picture, could be a way to go because you're able then to, it works with their model and they're okay with you coming back frequently to make those changes.
Okay, thank you. Well, at this point, we're going to change the space of this conference so that we can have question and answer. And I'm going to say anybody who wants can type in questions on the Q&A. And if anybody decides that they also want to show their faces, they're welcome to. So I'm going to turn on my webcam for now. Okay, so anybody who wants can see me if they want to. And if you have questions to ask, just type it in the Q&A box. And Wong, and hopefully one of our panelists or our two audiologists can answer. Hopefully I'll try to provide answers. So does anybody have any questions? So, yeah. Okay, so while waiting for people to ask questions, I don't know if anybody has questions, but they're welcome to type in a question. Otherwise, otherwise,
Wendy, I was gonna jump in and just say very quickly, you three panelists, absolutely fantastic. You are far too kind to me and Marshall. You are more than welcome to have Marshall on the phone with your audiologist anytime you want.
thank you, Brian, for that volunteering. But it is true that it is a mutual situation. The musician can't just come in and say, it doesn't sound right. And Charles and everyone is quite right on that. The jargon has long kept us apart. And there's no reason for that. So I think it's endeavors like this that are actually excellent. Thank you. And thank you for all the kind words, Brian.
It also helps to travel to Toronto and take Marshall out to lunch, which I did once. So that works as well.
Yes.
I was actually in Toronto for the CHAA conference a couple of years ago. It's really a wonderful city.
Okay, well, this is Wendy. Somehow the people are having trouble using the Q&A, so I'm going to go ahead and pop up the chat box. And anybody who wants to type in, me might find it easier to use than the Q&A. I'm sorry about that. I actually never tried the Q&A while I was in training for using this platform, but people can actually try typing in something. I hope this works, although we might have to wait a little bit for people to type in questions. There was a
Wendy.
Question here about... question earlier about whether anyone has tried using the iPhone-compatible hearing aids. I don't even know if which hearing aids are iPhone-compatible, so can Marshall or Brad or Brian give us an idea of which are iPhone-compatible?
At this point in time, as of where are we now, November of 2016, there are three manufacturers, Oticon, ReSound, and Starkey. There is an inherent, there could be other ones coming down the pipeline. I'm sure there will be. We have a very large convention every year called the American Academy of Audiology, and that's usually in the spring, in the latter part of the spring. And that's where it's like the car manufacturers show the new wares. And so I think by then you'll see a lot more manufacturers going that route. The only drawback I can see and has been noticed in the literature and also the clinic is that when you use an iPhone or anything unconnected, Bluetooth is a very energy inefficient method. And many manufacturers will only have the iPhone as long as the battery is a number 13 size or larger, like a 675. But they really try to dissuade people from using the smaller 312 batteries or the very tiny one, the number 10 battery. The battery life can degrade from over 100 hours to probably just over 10 hours if you use it a lot. So that there is that problem. They are working on trying to improve Bluetooth with the 4.0 low energy version, but even that is problematical. Brian,
okay.
Any comments?
Thank you, Marshall.
I'll mention, Wendy, as a user of iPhone. I mean, I think I'm the only one who's on the panel here that's using it right. I'm using it right now. And I'm just plugged in because of the power of the iPhone. The batteries have been fine, and the experience has been just fantastic. I can't tell you. If it's something that you're considering, I would go for it. It really is worth trying. I just absolutely love it.
Okay.
So,
Tom Webb has – all right. Tom Webb asked, is there – I think this is for Brian or Marshall. He asked, do you have any suggestions for my audiologist on setting up the Starkey Muse for live music performance. That's probably a tough one.
Brad, do you want to start or
wait,
should I?
That way. Talk to this guy.
I've actually had.
I'm just here to volunteer, Marshall.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate that. Yeah, the check's in the mail. I've had very little experience with the Starkey Muse. I'm not convinced, and I've asked the researchers behind the scenes, I've asked all the representatives I can find, but I can't find out anybody that could definitively tell me how the Starkey Muse functions. My suspicion, and I could be wrong about this, is that it cannot handle the louder inputs characteristic of music, and that the phrase muse and the ads that go along with it showing sexy musicians are nothing more than advertising. That's my suspicion. I'm not sure, and I do apologize if I'm misrepresenting that, but nobody behind the scenes, none of the engineers can give me a straight answer on how the Muse does work. I personally never done any studies with the Muse, so that's one of the reasons that in my examples I'd given you earlier, Starkey was not among them. It could work very well, but nobody seems to know how to convey that to me.
Yep.
Okay.
So this is Brian. I'll chime in if I may, because I have used Starkey a bit, and the reason why I've used Starkey, and I can tell you I've trained on the Muse. I've actually not fit any musicians with the Muse, because there are other devices that I've been happier with lately. The peak input level on the SoundLens and on the 3 Series is about 107 decibels SPL. The Muse, if we called the manufacturer, we would get an answer on what the peak input levels are. I'm assuming that with Muse, SoundPoint, their self-adjustment is an option for that, and I would simply just recommend that you bring in your instrument, or even probably more likely is bring in a recording of yourself and play it back on a very high resolution stereo at a level that approximates your normal performance level, whatever level would be at your own ear, and do some of that self-adjustment for your music program only.
Okay, that's very helpful, Brian. Okay, so Janice wants to know, she says, I have a question regarding tweaking the hearing aid to better hear the higher notes on the piano. I'm not getting the right reverberation for the upper few notes. The hearing aids are fine otherwise. I just need to know what to ask my audiologist to get it to sound better. She has a Widex Super 440 Digital. So, Marshall, Brian, do you want to offer Janice any suggestions?
Well, if it's the Dream or the more recent Unique Widex 440 model, then it should be able to handle the higher levels at the front end. But having said that, it may be that a hearing in the 4,000 hertz region, which is the top end of the piano keyboard, is so poor that more is less. In other words, if they were to artificially create more amplification there so that these sounds would be audible, it would be in a region of her ear that is so distorted anyway that it would be worse for her. Now, with speech, we use frequency transposition, where we take the higher frequencies and move them to lower frequencies, and that would work, of course, for speech. But as I said earlier in my talk, that if you use it for music, you destroy the entire harmonic structure. Usually, in a case like that, I get benefit from actually decreasing the amount of amplification in that damaged region of their ear, which may be, in her case, at around the 4,000 hertz area. But I don't think there's any other technology that would resolve that. Brian, do you agree?
Yeah, okay.
Just giving the thumbs up to that, Marshall. Just giving the thumbs up to that. Yeah, completely agree. And this actually speaks back to Nancy's point about the her Phonak hearing aids having the compression. To be clear, there's a difference between sound level compression and frequency compression. Some of the manufacturers, and Phonak is one of them, by default sets a frequency compression because depending on how much hearing loss you have above 2,000 hertz, that frequency compression can be fantastic to help you to understand what people are saying. And it is god-awful for music, as Marshall was saying, because it just really messes up the harmonic structure. So for Nancy, I am not your audiologist, and I am not giving you audiological advice. This is for general teaching. But have a separate music program that you can use a remote control or a push button on your hearing aids to switch into that has Phonak calls that frequency compression. They call it sound recover. Turn off sound recover. In this particular individual, talking about her piano, those upper notes, I would just, again, fully agree with Marshall, not knowing what her hearing loss is like, it may be better to reduce the amount of gain for those high frequencies rather than increase the gain.
Okay. Kathleen has a question.
Wendy. There's one more point about that. If indeed there is so much distortion in the ear that a hearing aid would actually make the situation worse, we call that in the field a dead region in the cochlea, or cochlear dead regions. That was actually propagated by a gentleman that Brian had mentioned in his talk, Brian Moore, another Brian, I guess. And Brian Moore actually has a special test for that called the TENS test, T-E-N-S. Clinically, what I do in my clinic, I have a piano in my office. And although, quite frankly, any piano or even one of those cheapy Casio old electronic keyboards from the 1980s, and what I have my clients do is they go up in semitone intervals, white, white, black, white, black note up, and they stop when two adjacent notes sound the same pitch. If they sound different, that's great, but if they start to sound the same, that's usually an indication of a dead or severely damaged region of the ear, and the audiologist when programming the instrument should stay away from that area. This is something you can do at home on your own piano if you do have one. Go up gradually with your hearing aids or without, it doesn't matter, and go up with adjacent notes, and when you find that two notes seem to be similar, more similar than they should be, it's best to stay away from that region. That would be consistent with a dead region in your cochlea.
Could I jump in with a follow-up question to what Dr. Marshall Chasen is talking about, Wendy?
Sure, go ahead.
Would it make sense for those of us who live near or in big metropolitan areas to see if there might be a church nearby or another facility that has a piano, and then the audiologist and patient walk over there? Or do you need the piano to be right next to all of your equipment, and would that solution not work?
Well, I think it's romantic to stroll down the street to one of those beautiful cathedral churches, but they are full of reverberation, which is not always the best situation. It may obscure or mask out what you want to look at. I'm a little bit lazy. I'm 61, so I don't walk a lot as much as I used to, but I think it's much more convenient to have a piano in the office. We test them with all sorts of instruments that they bring in. While they can bring in their guitar, their clarinet, or the violin, they can't bring in a piano, which is really why I have the piano. But for this test that I just mentioned, which is a pretty standard test I give now to all my clients that have anything to do with music, it can be performed on a really inexpensive old electronic Casio, other, you know, little cheapy things that you might even get at a garage sale, because it's difference that you're looking for. So it doesn't have to do with the quality, but it's the same or different issue that is important.
Okay. All right. Okay, so we have a couple more questions. Okay, it has to do with, okay, Kathleen had this question. She has, she said, I have tonal distortion without using hearing aids. You remove my hearing aids and use a custom fit earplug with a 9, 12, or 15 dB filter, depending on the situation. Are there any hearing aid or settings that could help her? I don't understand the question, but I'm hoping one of you do.
Well, I think that she's just described what sounds a lot like a cochlear dead region. And sometimes, such as many ears, which is a type of a syndrome many people have, that gives them a severe or moderate hearing loss, but very poor discrimination. There's usually a lot of damage to the nerve endings in the inner ear, the cochlea, and any amplification there can be problematic. I've suggested that to my other clients. That is, you just remove it from the equation. So you use an earplug that takes it away completely. But that's most likely what that is, and there's not a lot that you can do other than to avoid that region of the ear. Or in her case, you can plug it up. She can also use what we call a crossover or a bicross hearing aid, where you plug up the really offending ear, but you can fool the ear into thinking it's hearing by routing the sound to your slightly better ear through a wireless signal. That's called a cross or bicross. It's an acronym that stands for contralateral routing of signal, a technology that was invented in 1966 by Earl Harford, who, by the way, just passed away in the last month. A brilliant idea. Ryan, any other suggestions?
Okay. So, Brian,
sorry about that, Marshall. We were breaking up quite a lot. Are you all able to hear me any better?
I can hear you. Well, fine. Okay.
All right. So what I was understanding from Marshall's description with the individual who said that without hearing aids, when she hears, certain tones, it actually has a distortion to it. I wonder if that actually has a loudness component to it as well, in that if the music is a little bit softer, it sounds cleaner. And if it gets louder and louder and louder, that it actually starts to distort. That is something that does happen occasionally. What I'm thinking of is something called diplacusis, D-I-P-L-A-C-U-S-I-S. And this can have a loudness component to it, such that at some softer level, the tone is clearer, and as it gets louder, it starts to have more of a splatter across the area of the cochlea that has the damage. And in that case, I would actually think about using...
Connection.
Sorry about that. I got a little disconnection thing. I'm going to jump back in with you guys. But using a hearing aid called... the Edemotic Research Music Pro electronic hearing protection device, etymotic.com, and look up Music Pro, P-R-O, because that'll attenuate the higher sound levels and actually has a little bit of a boost for the softer sounds. That might be a little bit of an option for some folks. It does have it's an analog circuit, so tends not to have some of these issues that we've talked about with the distortions from digital signal processing.
Okay.
Right, you're quite right.
Yeah. Marshall,
so that hearing aid that he just talked about is called the K-Amp, and it's a 1988 analog technology. And we're constantly playing catch-up to that problem we had solved in 1988.
Okay. We are running a little low on time, so I'm going to summarize a question that some of our singers have. Don Mollenkopf was asking that if you talk about playing an instrument while getting ear molds made, if I'm a vocalist, should I sing? So that's a very good question. If you're having ear mold made, what do you do?
Brian can finish since he's working in that domain right now. But it was Robert Oliveira, O-L-I-V-E-I-R-A, back in 1987 in a magazine called Ear and Hearing. And he was able to demonstrate that it's the front part, the anterior part of the ear canal moves as you open and close your mouth. And you can verify that by sticking your finger into your ear and opening and closing your mouth. And you'll see the back part, the front top, the bottom don't move, but the front does move forward and back. And so a singer, you should find the widest that he or she opens their mouth and keep it there in a bite block fashion, or just keep it open for at least first 2 to 3 minutes of an ear mold impression, and you'll get a very nice seal along the front part, the anterior part of the ear canal. Brian, that's your area now with Lantos. Maybe you can add something.
Okay, I am going through, I'm scrolling through all these. Oh, yeah, one more question has to do with, and I think this is not necessarily related to hearing aids, but someone asked, do you have any suggestion for choir conductors who must listen to a choir and then successfully field a question from the back row? And I thought that was a very interesting question too, but I almost think I actually conduct a very small bell choir at work, where we have 8 people. Fortunately, my bell choir is very close to me because we're all seated in a very crowded conference room at work. But I think when you are conducting an actual choir, even at a church or somewhere where the distance between the conductor and the singer is further away, I almost think the conductor is going to have to use an assistive listening device. But I would be willing to hear what Marshall and Brad and Brian think about that. Or anybody else.
Do you want to go first, Brian? I think Brian had a wonderful suggestion last time, the Music Pro from Atomotic Research. It gives a slight amplification for soft sound, attenuation for louder sound. So it's like cupping your ear, and that will certainly assist you with hearing. Brian, any input? I think we've lost Brian.
Yeah, no, sorry about that, Marshall. I can hear through my computer audio, but I couldn't hear other people through my telephone audio. I was muting one to the other, so I apologize. I missed some of the previous questions around the shape change of the ear canal. You're welcome to email me after the fact. But then, Marshall, you were talking about now, I believe, with the being able to hear from the back row. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, actually, the question was actually more a comment.
Hold on.
It was more of a comment. The woman thought that your talk was the best talk she's ever heard in her life, and she thinks you're pretty sexy. It's something like that. And then she went on and asked specifically about a choir director who could hear the choir, but when after during a break would be able to address a question from far away from the back row, what would you suggest? And I talked about the suggestion you had made with the Music Pro electronic amplifier earplug from Atomotic Research. And now it's your turn.
Okay, right. So one of the things that I like about that Atomotic Research Music Pro earplug is that it has different settings where in one setting it is just, it lets soft to average sound through without doing any attenuation. And then for very loud sound, it attenuates. In another setting, it actually boosts soft sound and then it still attenuates the very loud sound in a very clean sort of way. I've had a couple of musicians who just found they had so much difficulty using hearing aids, but they could hear their own instrument very well and the instruments around them, but their biggest challenge was hearing the conductor say, okay, let's pick this up at measure 42. Wait, 42, 32, what? And they just needed a little bit of a boost in order to hear the conductor. And so that Atomotic Research Music Pro earplug gave only 6 decibels of boost for sound that would be coming from, say, the conductor's distance, and they were able to hear just well enough to be able to just pick up at the right measure. And so, again, it's very situational as far as how much hearing loss you have, but that's one example of some technology that can sort of get you there a little bit. If that particular 6 decibels is not enough, there is another, you would think of it as a personal sound amplification product or a PSAP called the Atomotic Bean, B-E-A-N, that does more amplification, and it is also an analog device. These are relatively inexpensive, compared to, you know, your typical digital signal processing hearing aids?
Okay, well, it's getting, okay, so we're about out of time, and I want to thank everybody who came, everybody who presented, everybody who listened in, and but last but not least, I also would like to thank our card reporter, Mirabai Knight. She is writing this two-hour session from New York City, and so Mirabai, thank you so much for doing this, for providing the caption for this event. So before everybody, I stop this web conference, I want to thank everybody for being here. Have a great evening. And and by the way, if you enjoy this session, this 2-hour seminar, do think about donating to us, because we are always looking for funding to do things like this. I chose not to request registration this time because I was curious to see how many people would sign up. But in the future, we're probably going to charge something. So I thank everybody for being here. And if you have suggestions for future topics, future talks, please go ahead and send them to me. I can I'm going to type in our email address for those who don't know. So you can just go ahead and send your suggestion to us. Hang on. So that's our email address. And so have a great evening, and maybe we'll do this again sometime next spring. Okay. Bye, everybody. Bye.
Bye-bye, everyone. Thank you so much.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Bye, everyone.
you can call in. If calling in, please put your phone on mute. And there's a chat box on the lower left corner. You went out for shopping?
Yeah.
What'd you buy?
Just
snacks?
I bought oil, vegetables, berries, yogurt.
Oil, vegetable, and berries. Okay.
Done with your meeting?
Yeah.
How'd it go?
Pretty well. We had a couple of technical issues, but overall it went well.
It's hard to do it. People always have technical issues because they have different computers.
No, that's not the problem. The problem is that the recording mechanism stopped recording halfway.
Well, probably because you said record for 1 hour, right? That was the contract?
We're supposed to be able to record for 2 hours.
2 hours?
I think. Let me see.
Because you started early, first of all.
Started at 2:50.
Right.
And
started
you started
early.
To record
to
until
at 3.
5.
So, what was the contract for?
Recorded for 2 hours.
2 hours? So what are you going to do now?
Well, I'm going to talk with my representative there.
Okay, why did you just stop recording halfway through? What software is this? What bullshit is
it? It's not, it's WebEx.
Huh?
No, it's not WebEx. It's a different product, but I really, really love
not
it.
Not as good as WebEx.
It is not WebEx, thank God.
Well, WebEx could have recorded and not have a problem because it's mature software.
The platform is called Omni something.
Omni something?
I don't remember. But it's, okay, see, what is it called? I don't know. I'll have to look.
Maybe the software is.
No, the software is excellent. It's just that it was other.
It's excellent, but it doesn't record.
So you record, but the recording part is still under beta. The recording part is under beta.
Ah, so you use beta software.
Well, apparently it's not 100%.
I hope no one paid for this.
Nobody paid for that, don't worry.
How many people?
25 people. That's pretty good. I'm happy.
That's not bad.
That's excellent. 25 people watching.
I could have padded your numbers if you wanted. I could have logged in.
No, don't do that. I don't want anybody to come just to pad their numbers.
Can I pad your numbers, please? Please, please, please. I want to pad your numbers.
You know what George Takei wrote?
What did he write?
Let's see. He wrote, George, he said, Melania Trump had pledged to take on cyberbullying as a top priority as First Lady. I suggest she begin with her husband.
I suggest that she what?
I suggest that she begin with her husband.
Right. That's correct.
Yeah.
That's what I say, too. I can't believe you put all the fish in the freezer. What are you thinking?
What?
Why'd you put all the fish in the freezer?
Oh, I wasn't planning to use all the fish today.
What fish were you planning to use?
Hmm. That's a good question.
I want you to apologize to everyone in the house.
What?
I think Tom Sietsma is gay.
What?
I think Tom Sietsma is gay. Because he said something about his significant other.
Tom Sietsma is gay.
I'm wondering.
Tom Sietsma, the food critic?
Yeah.
Wow.
Although some people do call their